Good evening, y'all. I would like to call to order the Planning Commission meeting of Thursday, September 18th, 2025. Carla or Haley, will one of you call roll?
Yes, Chair Brinson.
I am here.
Commissioner Cabe.
Here.
Commissioner Frye.
Present.
Commissioner Hadley.
Present.
Commissioner Lynn is excused with absence. Vice Chair Mosier.
Here.
And Commissioner Bobick.
Here. Excellent, thank you. Move to approve the agenda. Any changes? We are good. Moving on to approval of meeting minutes. Any comments, questions? Excellent. Next up, public comment.
We have, oh, sorry, we have one in-person and one remote. So in-person will go first. And Jack Malik, if you could step up to the podium and say your name and city of residence, please.
Hi, my name is Jack Malik. I'm a resident of the city of Shoreline, last 24 years. Former member of the Planning Commission myself. Love this group. Thank you for all that you do. I wanted to speak to, I believe it's Economic Development 2 in the batch amendments regarding adaptive reuse. That's the term that's been characterized. That was actually Laura's idea. We're both with the Shoreline Chamber of Commerce. I'm just here representing myself. But definitely, you know, we really need some form of interim step, baby step, towards allowing businesses to get out of their garage and into a brick and mortar or into a location that has more presence towards a busier street, more visibility, that type of thing. We have less than 2% available vacancy in this city for businesses trying to start up. And the ones that we do have are between $50 and $60 a foot plus triple net. And, you know, with new, you've seen it with Five Guys and over there at the Merlone-Geyer project, the Sears Central Market. That's just not enough. That's not enough to visit our real goal. One of the two principal goals that I'm most concerned with, which is housing, 13,000 new in the next 20 years and 10,000 new jobs in the next 20 years. And I think to really keep the character of Shoreline, we need to allow for our small businesses to flourish here. And anyway, in particular, the adaptive reuse is different from the NR 1, 2, and 3 home business because it allows you to, well, if it were to be accepted the way we've drafted it, it would allow you to use that kind of residential home without having to make substantial costly changes. That's the goal here. You know, we realize that ADA bathrooms, ADA accessibility have to have that, that's federal. But beyond that, in terms of lighting, signage, parking, hardscape, other types of permitting and whatnot, if you look at many of the homes over in the MUR 70 in that Fifth Avenue corridor between the two light rails, which I think is an ideal location for some of that, some of what we're proposing, it is, you know, the home values are a dollar and the land holds all the value. So you're instantly gonna hit 50% in terms of your improved value and trigger a rising to all current code. And that's too costly, it defeats the purpose. The purpose here is to allow people an opportunity to do something chic and fun and build on it. Plus, they can own their own land, and that way they can borrow against it when they need payroll, when they need, you know, in difficult times, and when they need to cover inventory and whatnot. So small business loans in that regard are popular, and it's helpful. They don't have that right now. I think this is a real boon. It may be something that we only allow for a certain amount of time or within a certain sub area for planning. I think that's up to you all to decide how that should look. Myself, I really do believe the area in between the two light rails along at least a couple streets would really be welcomed. And that's my thought. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one more in-person comment, and that is Laura Grauer. If you could please state your name and city of residence, please.
Hello, I'm Laura Grauer. I actually live in Seattle, but I am the past president of the Shoreline Chamber of Commerce, and I'm here on behalf of the chamber. We did submit this the same proposal that Jack was just referring to about adaptive reuse. I wanted to share a couple of stories. I have a friend of mine I've been in a Toastmasters club with for 8-10 years, and she's a CPA, and she was looking to find a location for her business. She heard light rail was coming to Shoreline and all the zoning changes were made. She bought a house with the intent to put her office in that house and discovered all the upgrade requirements in order to convert that house. And she promptly sold that house and opened her office in Seattle. So that's one person. I know of a person who was considering opening a coffee shop near one of the light rail stations in a home, again, in a house. And before buying the house, discovered all the things that would have to be done if they wanted just, I mean, it's really just putting a sign out in front triggers every single thing that a new apartment building would have to do. So parking regulations and frontage, things like that, and it literally isn't feasible without tearing the house down. So it's a big problem. I have more stories that have come through about people who are interested in making these, especially the light rail areas, that's where I'm hearing about it, making those areas kind of a destination, maybe opening a little restaurant. If you picture Fremont, they have a lot of little shops, little stores you can go shopping in, and it's clearly an old house. Things like that, people are really interested in doing. And like Jack said, and this was me too, I was shopping for commercial space. There's literally nothing available. And if it's available, it's $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a month. And so a small retail or food establishment just can't move into Shoreline. So this would really, really help with that. And I'm not totally clear how it connects with the thing that was passed recently with all the businesses can open up in homes throughout the city. Those houses might run into similar issues if they want to put a sign out in front of the home. They might run into the same problems that they literally cannot do it without tearing their house down. So, anyway, we are very strongly supportive that you guys, we really hope that this will go through and be something that helps welcome small business to Shoreline. Thank you for your time.
Okay, and we have one remote person who is Kevin Barrett. And Kevin Barrett, if you could please state your name and city of residence, and you are now unmuted.
All right. Hi, my name is Kevin Barrett. I am the president of the Shoreline Chamber. Good evening, commissioners, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. I am representing the Shoreline Chamber of Commerce, and I'm here on behalf of the members and our broader Shoreline business community to speak in support of the proposed change to Development Code 20.50.230, the same as what Jack and Laura were speaking to. The current code requires that when a single family home is converted to commercial use, the property must be brought up to full site improvement standards. While well-intended, this requirement has created a major financial barrier for small businesses and property owners who want to bring new services into our community. The cost of these improvements can easily run into tens of thousands of dollars and make it impractical for many entrepreneurs and effectively close the door on potential business opportunities. The proposed change provides a more balanced and reasonable path forward. It allows small businesses to repurpose existing residential structures without being burdened by disproportionate infrastructure costs, while still ensuring that significant new development or expansion projects meet the city's improvement standards. This adjustment supports economic growth, lowers the barrier for local entrepreneurs, and encourages more commercial viability across Shoreline. On behalf of the Chamber, I want to thank city staff and this commission for considering this change. I urge you to move it forward. And though I am a citizen of Briar, I believe in Shoreline so fully as the president of the chamber that I would love to have your support for this. So thank you for your time and your service to the community.
Thank you. Okay. Moving on to study items, of which we have two. First up, development code amendments, the 2025 miscellaneous batch amendments.
Good evening, Commissioners. Elise Kime, planning manager here at the City of Shoreline. So for our first agenda item, we're going to discuss, yes, these miscellaneous or batch amendments. And first up, we'll do a recap on co-living housing, which Kevin, associate planner with the city, is appearing virtually, is going to sort of go over that recap and follow up on some commission questions from last time. Then we're going to run through the proposed development code changes and then open it up for commission discussion. And I have a list of the changes here. My thought is to sort of go through the slides rather quickly, and then if there's one that you want to come back to, maybe raise a hand or something, and I'll try to note it down and so that we can circle back to it at the end if there's any that you're that you have questions on or want to discuss further.
Can I interrupt? Do you all see that the slides are mirrored on the online, possibly? Actually, Kevin, can you tell us if the slides are mirrored when you're looking at it?
They read correctly on my side.
Okay. On our little thing, they're backwards. But if they're fine for the world, then we're probably okay.
Goodness.
Okay. We're good? Okay, carry on.
All right, good evening. So, co-living housing, we're back again. And just a refresher that this is a state requirement under House Bill 1998. Some of the main components are regulating density is 1/4 of one dwelling unit for a sleeping unit. And we can't make anything for co-living stricter than we do for any other type of apartment building. So since these limited policy choices that we have are limited by House Bill 1998, we rolled that into the batch amendment.
Kevin, can you speak up louder, please?
Yes, of course. Is this better?
Try it again.
Can you hear me now?
I think so.
All right. So how is minimum density calculated? We're going to multiply the minimum number of dwelling units by 4. So if the minimum density is 1, the number of sleeping units you need is 4. If it's 4 density, then it's 16. It just goes that way for calculating sleeping units to dwelling units. Regulating the size of communal living spaces. The commission did ask, can we make a minimum size so we don't have substandard kitchen sizes? Well, we don't have kitchen sizes for multifamily standards, and the IBC does cover how limited a space can be for a kitchen size. And so what we did do is define kitchen facilities with no specific size requirements, and all the other dimensions for the IBC will apply, so they can't make any smaller than any other types of kitchens. Open space standards. We talked about, are they going to have limited open space, the same open space? Basically, we're going to make the sleeping units comply with the same standards as dwelling units. So it's 250 square feet in the neighborhood residential zones and 50 square feet in commercial or mixed use zones. So we talked about what types of commercial development. We talked about converting existing commercial development to co-living if we're going to require ground floor commercials. We discussed, and it's most likely hotels, motels, of which there are about 3 on Aurora. And we have talked about making those exempt from the ground floor commercial standards, but all other commercial conversions to co-living would comply with the same as multifamily units. The commission did ask about other names for co-living. We'll propose micro-housing or residential suites, which are listed in the guidance documents, as alternative names for co-living housing, which the commission can choose from. And the commission also asked about shared homes and how they're different from co-living. Homes are treated as a dwelling unit. So if you have a house in the NR zone and you have roommates, we're not going to regulate it as co-living. It's just a house. A sleeping unit definition is different than a dwelling unit. And we know that sleeping units and bedrooms are different. And so we're not going to regulate bedrooms as sleeping units.
Thanks, Kevin. So we're about to get into a long list of proposed development code amendments. And just for some context, when commission is making a decision about a recommendation for development code amendments. These are the three criteria to keep in mind. These are what ultimately city council will be using, is that the amendment is in accordance with the comprehensive plan. It will not adversely affect public health or welfare, and it's not contrary to the best interests of residents and property owners in Shoreline. So we have four sort of different sections of code that have a variety of amendments, and actually a lot of them are related to co-living housing. On the slides, you'll note that there will be a parenthetical P, C, or A to clarify if it's a policy choice, a clarification, or administrative. And again, for those co-living housing ones, they are noted as a policy choice, but just that it is a constrained policy choice because there are some state mandates to be aware of. So, like I said, I'm going to go through these rather quickly, and then please just try to raise a hand to catch my eye, and I can note down if there's ones that we want to return to. First up, definitions, clarifying the difference between a bed and breakfast and co-living housing. Adding a definition of co-living housing consistent with the state requirements. Clarifying what a dwelling unit is and that it is not co-living housing. Adding a definition of kitchen facilities, which appears in both co-living housing and in dwelling unit definitions. Adding a definition for major pedestrian corridor. This has to do with conversions of commercial space to residential, and there's some state bills that say you can't prohibit that unless it's on a major pedestrian corridor, so we need to identify what that is. Eliminating the definition of microhousing. This is being replaced by co-living housing. Small change to remove the term boarding home from nursing facilities, again related to co-living housing. Having a definition for sanitation facilities, again related to co-living housing. Having a definition of sleeping unit. This is consistent with the building code and clarifies that a sleeping unit and a bedroom are not the same thing. Next, we're getting into our administrative procedures. This is just striking reference to boarding house. That's going away, again, for co-living housing. Non-conformance, this is just a cleanup. We had missed a reference to R6, that's an old zoning designation. Now it's changed to NR3. Temporary use, this is more of a policy choice, trying to allow specifically in commercial zones, allowing sort of temporary retail, maybe pop-up type things, a Christmas tree lot or a fruit stand, something like that, without the need for a temporary use permit, which can be kind of expensive. And clarifying how we calculate time of temporary use permit. It's only when it's operating. Here we are striking a reference to an already struck section of code. Here, this is more of a policy choice related to the neighborhood business zone. This is one of our commercial zones. It's one of the only, it is the only commercial zone that allows townhomes, which are typically an entirely residential form of development. In a commercial zone where we do not have very high vacancies of commercial spaces. So the concept is to remove that reference as an allowed type of use. Because again, the neighborhood business zone is one of those zones that requires ground floor commercial, but by allowing townhomes, we essentially do an end run around all of that work. So that's the proposal here. This is related to that as well. It's just striking single-family attached townhomes as a permitted use in the neighborhood business zone. This strikes reference to boarding house and replaces it with co-living. Co-living is required to be allowed in all zones that allow six or more multifamily units. So in Shoreline, that's everywhere except in R3. Here is just a clarification that bookshops are allowed in NR1. This is one of our neighborhood commercial allowances, and it still showed that it was a conditional use, but it is in fact allowed. This is clarifying again related to neighborhood commercial. This line item was added to clarify personal services are allowed in neighborhood zones, neighborhood residential zones, and it's just clarifying, yes, they're also allowed in commercial zones, which they were previously. This is related to temporary construction facilities and temporary real estate offices. So Often there needs to be some sort of staging area or leasing space that's on a temporary basis based on new construction, and allowing that to occur without a temporary use permit, which again can be costly and additional process. Proposal is for our campus zones, which have master development plans, to not have their list of permitted uses in the development code, because you update a master development plan to change the uses, and then to also have to update the development code in order to change them again, it's just sort of adding double process. So we're recommending to strike that and just have it go through master development plan updates. This is specific to our station areas, again, replacing boarding house with co-living and striking reference to micro-housing. Accessory dwelling units are, by council action, they're to be capped at 1,200 square feet, but the exception there, it still referenced the old 50% of the principal unit, which is not accurate anymore, so it's just a cleanup. Adult use facilities, this is related to really adult retail facilities. So if they are in the MB zone and engaged solely in adult-oriented retail, that it be allowed to operate in the MB zone and not necessarily need to meet the buffer requirements from residential zones. I know that's sort of hard to conceptualize, so we have some maps here. Those bright purple, those are our MB zones, and then you see a variety of buffers from parks, schools, libraries, and daycares. These are all areas where adult-oriented retail would be subject to buffers, but if it's also subject to buffers from residential zones, you see the area, it diminishes greatly. It's essentially allowed sort of up kind of near the Costco parking lot, a little bit down in Shoreline Place, and then there's a little bit sliver of it over in North City. Boarding houses, recommend to be entirely struck because that's going to be co-living housing. Cemeteries and columbariums. Columbarium right now is only allowed if it's accessory to a church, which doesn't make a ton of sense, so our proposal is to strike that reference because we have columbariums around without churches in cemeteries. So the next is co-living housing. I'm going to pass it back to Kevin for a brief summary.
All right, yeah, so co-living housing, we put a lot of the legislative requirements into an index criteria. So one sleeping unit is equivalent to a quarter of a dwelling unit for calculating density. When located on a major pedestrian corridor, we'll have to provide ground floor commercial unless the co-living is adaptive reuse of temporary lodging, which is another way of saying hotel, motel. That's what we classified all of those types of uses under. In design standards, they'll be subject to NR design standards in the NR zones or commercial multifamily zone design standards in commercial multifamily zones. Bike parking will be the same as multifamily, so we're treating them equally there. We talked about previously, can we have a maximum sleeping unit to kitchen ratio? And so we did talk about that internally and realized that 1-8 is better than 1-1. So we are doing no more than 8 sleeping units to each kitchen, and kitchens aren't counting towards that open space. So they're not saying that all our common open space is in the kitchen. And anywhere we're requiring open space, like we talked about before, is going to be on a per dwelling unit basis. It'll be treated the same as a sleeping unit basis. And so this is the justification, which is House Bill 1998 and the stuff that we discussed back in August.
Thanks, Kevin. Next is striking a reference to supplemental index criteria for cottage housing. Cottage housing has been rolled into the neighborhood residential design standards, so we don't need it anymore. Daycare facilities, making it clear that daycare to facilities, that's when there's more than 12 adults or children under care, are allowed in NR3 and NR2 zones with a conditional use permit and allowed on a school or house of worship, which already has to have a conditional use permit in these zones, that they'd be allowed to operate there. Home occupation strikes reference to boarding house. Again, we're just getting rid of that term. Temporary construction facilities. So this describes those criteria that a temporary construction facility like a job shack or a parking area would need to meet, essentially that they be allowed to operate on site during active construction and not just be left there for indeterminate amounts of time. Temporary real estate office, again, this is when you've got a new residential building or a development coming in and they didn't need a sales or leasing space on a temporary basis, not making that office facility come up to commercial design standards if it's only there on a temporary basis, but also not making it go through a temporary use permit. And this one is to eliminate the required minimum density in NR3 and NR2 zoning designations. Minimum density has been enforced in our station areas where we're trying to see a lot of transformative redevelopment, but has not been enforced in our residential zones where we're trying to see a little bit more of a modest infill. So what we've noticed by having these minimum densities in here is that it's making it hard for things like an ADU to get built, which is something that we were hoping we'd make more easily allowable. This one might be hard to see, but there's a little parenthetical two next to the minimum setbacks to garages or carport entries. Essentially, if you have a townhouse development, that's often a unit lot subdivision and internal lot lines, and you do not need to have a garage setback 20 feet from an internal shared lot line. That's pretty technical one. Building design standards. This is another one we've noticed. This is in our neighborhood residential design, is that existing buildings, maybe they're trying to do a remodel or addition, maybe adding a garage where there was a carport or something like that. They're really struggling to come up to the fenestration standards. We're noticing they're having issues with meeting fenestration standards. There'll be issues with energy code or structural design and requiring a facade that's just getting a modest addition to suddenly come up to fenestration standard really blows out the scope of anticipated construction. So the proposal is for existing buildings to not require them to meet specifically fenestration standards. This was one that we received several public comments about. This was our privately initiated development code amendment saying that if there's a residential use being converted to a commercial use, that it no longer require full site improvements. And importantly, this occurs in our commercial and station area zones and not in our neighborhood residential zones where we have sort of separate requirements that someone have a landscaping or a fence if they're operating a business in a residential zone. This one also came around from Planning Commission direction about co-living housing perhaps coming into adaptive reuse of an existing commercial space, that we allow co-living housing to be added to the list of items that do not require full site improvements if they're doing an adaptive reuse. And I think this is the final one, is building design. This is specific to our commercial zones, where previously we had prohibited any sort of chain link fencing that was not screened. Perhaps you have noticed in our commercial zone, there's in fact a lot of chain link fencing that is not screened. And so the recommendation is that this is a lower cost way for commercial properties to be able to secure their property, but by requiring it that it be vinyl coated if it's visible from the right of way, that creates some sort of design standard for this type of fencing. And those are all of the items. The comprehensive plan policy support, again, that's one of the criteria to consider. So staff have looked through the comprehensive plan to identify a couple of items, including updating the development code, focusing on building form to encourage residential development, allow small-scale commercial activity, and to consider the interests and needs of the entire community, both present and future, to allow for a variety of housing types, and to encourage adaptive reuse of underutilized commercial properties. The plan for next steps is for this to come back before Planning Commission for a hearing in October and then proceed to City Council for discussion and action. But now it's time for your discussion.
Thank you, Elise. I'm a little swirly, So maybe someone has an additional, an initial thought while I pull my own together. Or maybe we all just need a second. Okay, I have a thought. My first thought is the public comment conversation. That was, I just want to clarify, that is a suggestion. We have not integrated it into what you just presented. Is that correct? Or was it in there and I missed it?
This okay. is the one.
Perfect.
I think I like this one. I mean, I think that especially because if you think of it, it is in the station areas and it does encourage a reuse of a house that someone potentially already owns, and site improvements can be kind of onerous. And I'm okay with it too, because if you think about it, it just looks at it from a land use perspective. And if we look at it from a building code perspective, if you're spending a bunch of money, you're gonna have to do other improvements to the house anyway. So it's not gonna diminish like the quality of the house. And I think it might actually make the structure better performing because of other requirements that'll be triggered, which are already expensive, probably more important to the use than lights. Not to diminish the importance of lights.
Good. Those buttons are tricky. I want to concur with our public comment speakers that it's very important for us to make sure that we're making space for the economic development plans that we have in our comprehensive plan to add the 10,000 jobs. We are a non-industry community, and so we need ways for our entrepreneurs to bring those jobs to where we are. And on our current economic landscape, it's our educated people with degrees, masters, and bachelors that are getting laid off, that are going to look to those entrepreneurial options as they re-career. So. Oh, and as a technical side note, wordsmithing, the college has voted to change their name and remove community. Oh. So you might want to, in anticipation of that becoming more public, just strike the community from that campus.
And Shoreline College.
Shoreline College.
Gotcha.
Cool.
I think doing this will make it so Shoreline is more walkable. So I agree with that.
I guess my question now, seeing that it's about site improvements, I was thinking a bit more into the sort of building reuse part. Okay. Is that also a barrier? And or is that a piece of this, or are we just talking about site improvements straight up reuse of a single family home?
These are site improvements, so this would be things like landscaping, lighting, signage, used to be parking, those types of items where just by function of change of use, there need to be a variety of different site improvements separate from building. So building improvements related more to the building code. If you are operating a business that's open to the public, there may be requirements there specifically around accessibility.
Right.
That is not what this is.
Okay.
That is handled in the building code.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Are we good on this one? All right. Other question? I have a question about bike parking.
Okay.
And numbers and math.
Okay.
And really, it might be a Kevin question, but it's about co-living housing and bike parking. Can you just remind us what the per unit sleeping and dwelling, since we're talking about them the same number, is for multifamily?
Yes, once I look at
the yeah, let me pull up the current bike parking.
Now you guys can have a competition on who's faster. Elise?
Short term?
Yes.
One per 20 dwelling units. So that would be one per 20 sleeping units. Minimum of two. Maximum of 20 spaces required. Long term, one per two dwelling units. That would be one per two sleeping units, minimum of two.
Okay, that actually makes total sense to me. I was just, if it was one for one, which I couldn't remember, I was like, are we going a little bit deep? But it makes sense to me. Anyone else want to talk about bike parking math? All right. What else did we have? We had temporary use permits. We had.
I'm glad to see that we're striking townhomes from the neighborhood business. Thank you. That's a good one.
Yes.
I have a question, mm-hmm. and I'm not quite sure what slide this is on. So what is the difference between co-living and renting out rooms in your house?
Trying to see if Kevin wants to.
He came.
Yeah, sorry. I had to unmute. But so renting rooms in your house, they're not sleeping in it, they're just bedrooms. Co-living can have bathrooms included in it. Like every room is a master bedroom with an ensuite bath. Or they could have kitchen facilities, but not both bathroom and kitchen facilities. So they're treated a little bit differently. And our standards, we wouldn't treat someone who had, let's say, five roommates as co-living, unless they're making it intentionally a co-living space, which typically is going to be a lot smaller rooms than you might find, because the minimum room size, I think, is 70 or 90 square feet.
Thank you. I think I understand that conceptually and like, you know, it when you see it kind of thing. But I'm wondering if y'all, as you administer the code, are going to run into stickiness where those two things, I'm sort of having flashbacks to when we were talking about what's a townhome. Is it going to be clear or are we going to sort of run into issues with applicants tripping over co-living versus a home, which we don't really like, we have single family homes, that has been a thing. We've tried to remove that language. So I'm just wondering, partially because in the origin story of the Seattle micro housing code, micro housing started as a 9-bedroom townhome. And that's and as a way to get through, it wasn't required to go through design review if you were a 9-bedroom townhome. Mm. So micro units originally were permitted that way. So I'm just, that's the piece, is I just want us to be careful to make sure we're not running into sort of administrative issues with the code by this feeling very similar but not distinct. I don't know if.
I think the development standards, for example, they're zone based and use neutral, right? So if okay. it's if you're in a multifamily zone, you're going to be meeting the multifamily design standards. Doesn't matter how many bedrooms or sleeping units you have. If you're in the neighborhood residential zone, you'll be meeting the neighborhood residential design standards, and it does not matter the number of sleeping units or bedrooms that you have, whatever it is that is being built there. If it's residential, it'll be meeting those design standards. I guess it is entirely possible that there's something we've not thought of where we could run into administratively something that's sticky. Ultimately, if someone's building a house, most likely we're going to review that like a house, and if they operate it with people renting out rooms, that's a house. So I think it's challenging to say. I know it when I see it. For what is co-living housing?
It's a 2027 batch amendment is what it is.
Potentially, yeah.
Okay. Sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
That sleeping units are independently rentable and lockable, and to start putting the building requirements on every bedroom in a house before you start getting into, is this worth it to try and get around a code? Exterior-wise, co-living as a NR single-family home or as a multifamily apartment, no matter what you look at on the outside, it's going to look the same. I think it's whether someone wants to go through the standard of trying to pass off a 12-bedroom apartment or an 8-bedroom house as something other than it is. The main thing I think people would want is maybe some sort of incentive to do that, like co-living is eligible for certain like MFTE programs or affordable housing programs that maybe a traditional single family home wouldn't. But as co-living is already rented out almost below or at MFTE rates, there might not be a need to do that anyways.
Okay, that makes sense.
I think it might be, this is totally off topic or kind of, but I think it would be helpful to have a chart that kind of says, you know, this is what not for us, but you know, like on the website mm-hmm. or when you talk to people, that says this is co-living and this is rentable rooms, so that people can kind of make a decision on the pros and cons of each. Because I too think there's some stickiness and some wiggle room a little bit. And I think that when that happens, it's best to be as clear as possible.
Feels less like a developer would trip over it and more like a single family homeowner might be like, or a detached or attached homeowner. You know, it's sort of when we start talking about ADUs and like, we have a morphing world of development types. All of this is brand new. So I think sort of living in that discomfort for a year or two to see what happens is probably also appropriate, in the sense that this might just be us, because we're talking about them together, being a sticky issue. Mm-hmm.
Are there standards that we're concerned that are different for co-living housing than would be for a detached residence?
I can't figure out how to define a 5-bedroom, and I get that they're slightly different, but a 5-bedroom home and a 5-sleeping unit dwelling thing, co-living mm-hmm. situation, those don't feel different to me. And so I'm not concerned about the code. I'm more just concerned about the fact that I can't clearly delineate these. Like when we were doing townhomes, and right. a townhome didn't feel separate than an attached house. Mm-hmm. So that's my concern, is just terminology. So I don't actually think there's a code problem, is based on the external standards being, the exterior standards being the same, you know, very clear and the same.
Yeah. I agree. I don't think it's a code problem.
Sounds to me like it's a word problem. Like, because there's co-housing, there's this co-living, and it sounds more like a roommate thing as opposed to an independent little box that you get, where you get your bathroom and your bedroom and your shared kitchen, where you have like an apartment manager versus let's move in together and save money.
You know? Yeah, I mean, co-living is like a dorm to me, right? Because when my son was in the dorms, they each had their own key to their own room and shared the kitchen.
But I think in this situation, in a dorm, you still have to decide who's going to do the chores. I mean, it's, and you can choose your roommate in a dorm sometimes.
Yeah.
When you're older.
I think it's a word problem. And I think that's, I think I personally would defer to staff on, if you all don't see this as an administrative problem, then it's probably not a problem. It's just us thinking about don't feel really clear. But if there's no place in the code where it needs to be clear as a decision point going one route or another, then I think it's fine. I don't know the code that well. So.
There's some housing near the UW that's called apartments.
That's this.
I know. And that to me is more clear. It's like immediately
that's
think.
That's a brand name.
I know, but it's like, that makes sense. I can delineate the difference.
I do appreciate that Kevin responded to our commenting about the name. I don't know.
Do any of the other names sound better?
No.
Okay.
I think the state used this, so let's not be different. I was just laughing that clearly it's a language problem, because it's a new thing that hasn't had, they can't use the term apartments. They started as apartments, but that's a brand. So we can't call them that. It's like Band-Aids. All right. I'm sorry, Elise. Okay. Focusing in, are there other development code amendments that folks want to discuss?
Just one step back to parking. Now that I'm actually reading it, just maybe a suggestion in that D to make a note that for bike parking, one sleeping unit equals one dwelling unit? Because I know when I read this, I still have 0.25 in my head. So I'm like, oh, you only need one biking for every 8 sleeping units.
Gotcha. Okay.
And if it's meant to be the other way, which I think is good, just to clarify.
Don't make us do math.
Yeah, I've got a question not related to the co-living. It's actually about the temporary use exemption amendment. More of a, I guess, a just general question. How, if we don't have any sort of permits for these shorter uses, how do we know to collect taxes or things like that for like retail sales?
I believe through business licenses, but I can check with our clerk's office because it, yeah, it doesn't necessarily matter the duration of operation. It's more about the dollar generated, which I think is $2,000 a year, but I can check.
Okay, thanks.
All right, I think you all made it through the 2025 batch amendments, unless there's something you want us to specifically look at, but it felt like it was pretty clear as you flew through them. I'll wait until you're done typing to keep to go on.
Sorry, just noting down.
The business license threshold will increase to 4,000 per year for 2026.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right, so I think that concludes this study item, if I'm correct, and we will move to a public hearing on the 16th, not tonight, no.
Oh.
Sorry. No, on this item, there will be a public hearing on October 16th.
Correct.
Unless something shifts. So we will move on to the next study item, which will require us to think more deeply about all the things. Environmentally critical areas code update.
Yes. Okay.
These maybe are two very meaty things to put on an agenda for
okay.
You all.
Let's see. And then
I know.
I see it here. We'll just wait for it to. Oh, maybe it's a specific, sometimes it's a specific slide deck, maybe, or I broke everything. We'll see what happens. Hang on. Oh, I think we got it.
You have achieved, at least, there you go.
All right, our next agenda item. All right, the next topic is about the critical areas code update. We're going to go through a little bit of recap of some of the ground that we've covered so far, and then talk about three substantive changes to the critical areas code, including riparian management zones, allowed uses, and report requirements. So first, as a recap, the critical areas code appeared before commission a few months ago, and the direction was to focus largely on that portion of the critical areas code that was in need of update due to recently published best available science. So it's all about streams, specifically the riparian management zone around streams. The Department of Fish and Wildlife published newly updated best available science that moves away from the sort of buffer paradigm of how we protect streams towards riparian management zones. specifically identifying five important ecological functions of riparian management zones, including shading the stream, bank stability, adding detrital nutrients like leaves and twigs and moss and stuff like that, large woody debris so a tree falls in into the stream, and then pollution removal. WDFW's guidance includes how you determine the size of a riparian management zone using something called site potential tree height. WDFW prepared a tool that can be used statewide, and in Shoreline specifically, it estimates a 202-foot riparian management zone for all streams in Shoreline. Previously, staff sought direction from Commission on whether or not to pursue this model that WDFW has recommended, or perhaps try to find our own modeling for what might be an appropriate riparian management zone size, and we were directed to use the site potential tree height tool. Subsequently, staff has consulted with WDFW about this 202-foot number, and they said it was okay to proceed with a 200-foot riparian management zone. It's just going to be a little bit easier for staff administering the code to message to members of the community. So that brings us into our first topic, the riparian management zone code. So this draft code recommends a 200-foot riparian management zone as the standard size for all streams in Shoreline, regardless of the water type. That's if the stream is seasonal, runs year-round, has fish in it, including salmonids. The riparian management zone code allows independent verification of site potential tree height because we know that we don't have accurate soils data for Shoreline specifically, so holding that space for a qualified professional to determine what that actually is with some site-specific data. The code also proposes to allow some reductions of that riparian management zone width with enhancement. Requires that the riparian management zone be increased if it's necessary and meets certain conditions, and notes that pipe streams, they do not have a riparian management zone, they're in a pipe, so that the vegetation really is not having any sort of relationship with the stream itself, so that stays as a buffer. Just to remind Planning Commission, this is the map shown previously of the riparian management zones in critical areas. This still shows the 202-foot buffer, but it's close enough. It's showing that it is an increased area of effect and that there are newly impacted parcels about 456 in the city. I'm not sure if it bumps down to 200, maybe we lose a couple. But that brings us to one of the topics that staff has proposed in the draft code, is to allow some reduction in riparian management zone width. So the 200 foot is the standard. Staff are recommending a 25% reduction be allowed to riparian management zones if they meet specific criteria. So if this is an untouched riparian management zone that's got beautiful trees and is doing a great job, that is not eligible for a reduction in riparian management zone width. If you're dealing with one that's already been impacted by development, maybe it's a lawn area that's not native vegetation, maybe it has like a tree or some bushes, then that might be a candidate for a reduction in riparian management zone width with an assessment, a specific site assessment of existing ecological functions of the riparian management zone done by a qualified professional. And then that reduction may be allowed if there's on-site enhancement of those existing functions. So we've got a simple diagram here showing that where the standard riparian management zone would be, allowing it to be reduced if there is enhancement on site. We have received comments back from Department of Fish and Wildlife about that, as well as our consultants. Fish and Wildlife, they do not recommend allowing any reduction in riparian management zone width, but if reduction is permitted, that it never be less than 100 feet, because that's the minimum necessary to maintain the pollution removal function of a riparian management zone. Since Shoreline standard riparian management zone width is 200 feet, a 25% reduction would be down to 150 feet, but we can make that clearer in the code. Our consultant felt that if it's demonstrated through a site-specific functional assessment, which is what we are proposing, that enhancement, and to prove that enhancement provides a equal or greater ecological benefit compared to an unimproved standard width riparian management zone, that this would be appropriate. So if you've got an area that's technically a riparian management zone, not doing much in the way of ecological functions, that being shade, bank stabilization, detrital nutrients, large woody debris, and pollution removal, well, then maybe allowing it to be reduced 25% if that area is enhanced. Are there any questions about that? Yes.
Do we have a sense of the cost of an assessment? I'm, with a ridiculous example of somebody's back patio is clearly paved. It's clearly, like, does that person need to go through a paid consultant to document that they have, you know, that they could qualify for this? Or is it just sort of, I see it, I know it?
This is more of a qualified professional needs to make an assessment, because if it's just a paved back patio, it really depends on the site conditions, what's going on in terms of ecological function. Mm-hmm. If it's a small paved patio and there's a bunch of beautiful conifer trees, that's probably performing some sort of ecological function and wouldn't necessarily be like an automatic candidate to say, oh yeah, you can totally reduce it, that's fine. Having this functional assessment, that's what our qualified professionals reviewing the draft code said, like, that's really an important criteria rather than just automatically reducing.
Got it. Do we know, do we have a sense of
the
cost?
I can ask what those costs might be. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm assuming your patio needs to have a stream within 175 feet.
I'm not talking about my own patio. Or I was just thinking about an egregious
said patio.
I was thinking about an my entire backyard is paved. You know, do I need to pay someone to tell the city that my entire backyard is paved, or is that?
Gotcha. If it's something like that, then we're probably where it's very clear that no ecological function is being performed. Yeah, you've got a parking lot or something. then we're. We're probably dealing more with the next slide where it talks about interruptions in riparian management zones. Yeah, so we have a couple of ways that we're trying to introduce flexibility in the code while still protecting the functions and values of the critical area. So this is just the first one.
Okay, thank you.
So this might be the next one is, when does a riparian management zone end? We know that in Shoreline, we're living in an urbanized and urbanizing environment where there's a lot of existing infrastructure and improvements in place that may be interrupting the ecological functions and values of a riparian management zone. So this section of code is meant to acknowledge that and not require very expensive assessments unless deemed necessary by the director. Because there could be some, we want to hold space for there may be a need for a qualified professional to assess, but most often what we see here is that the riparian management zone, previously the stream buffers, being interrupted by a roadway, and someone, yeah, trying to do an addition on their house, and we're saying, hey, you're in a stream buffer, and there's, what stream? And it's far away, it's across a road, there's no trees around. So the proposal here is to, by policy, say these are the times when a riparian management zone ends because the interruption to their ecological functions and values is just too great. So this would be roads, or if there's an existing structure, like, so if your house is a house between yours and the stream and you're trying to do a deck addition, that's probably not having much of a impact on the riparian ecosystem. If you're doing an addition on your house on the opposite side of the stream, so the stream's on your backyard and you just want to do a little bump out in front, that's fine. saying that the riparian management zone is not extending to the front of your house. Important, some criteria that perhaps wouldn't qualify if you've got a swing set or a child's play structure, that's probably not enough to interrupt the functions and values of a critical area. And the proposal here is that we not require a qualified professional to provide an assessment at all times, but still holding space for that might be necessary in certain cases.
On this diagram, is there between the house that's number three and the one to the left of it? Were we just showing it the example is like the road was the cutoff in that one, just to show different examples. There's not like anything qualifyingly different like about that one. Like number three stops at the back of the house, whereas like the house in front of number four, we're just showing that the road is the determining like cutoff, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Just making sure there was nothing subtle I was missing.
No.
Okay.
I think one other clarification that we might want to make on this is house number two is if there's not a clear, I mean, it looks like a clear property line delineation, but existing structure behind it, is that like exactly behind it? Is that a parcel behind it? If the property line were different?
We're holding space that it can depend because not all properties are flat and square.
Right.
Right, if you have a very large property and you know the house is over here and a different house is over here, but there's this chasm between them that's probably performing some sort of riparian ecosystem function, that might not be an appropriate candidate. So it's going to depend really on the site-specific configuration.
I think at least what might be helpful is to touch on a tiny bit of process. Like, house number two wants to, I don't know, pave their driveway. Pave a new driveway.
Mm-hmm.
Something egregious. They come, they're like, there's a house behind me. I mean, that's what I'm trying to work through is like.
It'd be handled administratively. So through staff, we would take a look at it and say, okay, like the mapped buffer or the mapped riparian management zone, like, goes across to the houses even across the street. And we'd say, okay, but the scope of work that you're doing and looking at the context of what is around you and that there's a structure between you, your area of work and the stream, we'd say that is fine.
Okay.
So it's handled administratively. It doesn't have to go to anyone specifically. If there are questions, a staff member could come to management or the director to say, hey, I'm not sure, this feels like an edge case, let's talk about it. And we can take a look at and really considering what are the functions and values of the riparian management zone. So they're detailed in the best available science provided by WDFW, understanding what is proposed to be done and what are existing conditions. I think a lot of homes will ultimately, their neighbors will sort of bear the brunt of the riparian management zone, but a number of those that are in sort of the outer reaches of the 200-foot buffer, they'll likely have existing development already interrupting those ecological functions.
Okay, thank you. I think this is the conversation that I was trying to think about the last time we were having this conversation, so I really appreciate these two slides and these two sort of pieces, so.
Yeah, the concept is that it's handled administratively. Oh.
Uh-oh.
Okay, we'll just
move on.
The concept is that it's handled administratively and that we can request an assessment by a qualified professional if necessary.
Okay, great.
But again, that's still handled administratively, so that'd be through a permit. They'd say, here's my memo from my qualified professional that says it's fine or it's not, and then, you know, we go from there. This brings us to our sort of next substantive topic, which is about allowed uses and activities in critical areas. So in critical areas generally and riparian management zones more specifically. This section of code, while there's been a lot of updates to sort of clarify language and make it a little bit easier to read and administer and understand what's being said, it didn't change a lot, except for a few things. So you're still allowed to maintain and repair existing structures. You're allowed to respond to emergencies. You're allowed to modify and do alterations if they meet specific criteria. We clarified that you're allowed restoration and enhancement. That doesn't necessarily just need to be removal of noxious weeds like blackberries and ivy, but if someone wants to, they just have a lawn and they're like, I would love to plant some Oregon grape and salal and some ferns, go do that, that's great, without making it a really onerous process for them to do so. We are proposing to allow new passive recreation. This is in response to the city growing and needing to maintain our parks level of service. A lot of park properties are impacted by critical areas, so maybe they want to put in a trail or some benches or a viewing platform. So if it's a passive recreation facility, to allow those if they meet specific criteria without needing to go through a special use permit process, which is time consuming and costly, and ultimately still allows the impact to occur with mitigation. So we're just saying by policy, we're going to allow it if it meets specific criteria, get a critical areas report, and get appropriate mitigation for passive recreation. So not like a, you know, a new recreation center that's like a building. We're talking parks and trails, those types of things. And then proposing minor expansion in a riparian management zone, which I'll get to in just a moment. Importantly, our allowed uses and activities still prohibit new impacts, large expanded impacts, or degrading any critical areas or increasing risks of any hazards. So that remains unchanged. So one of the proposals is to allow for a minor expansion of an existing structure in a riparian management zone. So this is riparian management zone specific. The proposal is to allow a 500-foot expansion on a legally developed property if it meets specific conditions, being that it has to be at least 100 feet from the stream, it cannot be closer than existing development, still needs to meet like the development standards of the zone, that there be on-site mitigation and a covenant restricting further development. We also received comments from WDFW on these as well as comments back from our consultant. WDFW is not supportive of this proposal and says that it does not is not supported by their best available science. They express concerns about an incremental loss to riparian management zones as, you know, various homes all do these additions, and that it is difficult to monitor over time, which is true, but it is possible to monitor it over time. They note that if it is kept in, that it should really just apply to areas where there is no remaining ecological function, so like a parking lot. It's like, okay, well, you can do an addition because there's nothing's going on there. So the intent behind this code was to make a policy choice essentially about what is reasonable on a lot, on a developed site, without requiring a property owner to go through a critical area's reasonable use permit. It's trying to strike that balance of environmental protection goals as well as private property rights, both of which are goals of the Growth Management Act. It puts in specific criteria, it creates specific limits on expansion, and requires mitigation in order to ensure that there is no net loss of ecological function, which ultimately would be the outcome of a critical area's reasonable use permit. Just they're going through this permit process, which is lengthy and time-consuming and expensive. Our consultant took a look at the draft code and felt that with these specific conditions, that there is a science-based support for a small one-time expansion without requiring a reasonable use permit if there is mitigation. And they provided some comments about some additional examples of mitigation that we can work to fold into this proposal. But that's where we are on minor expansions in riparian management zones as an allowed activity. Are there any comments about this one?
I'm assuming within this one as well that other requirements for critical areas like steep slopes still apply as well.
Correct. Yes.
So if the 500 square foot drops off precipitously, you still can't do it.
Right.
Like
you would be dealing with the requirements of that that critical area.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is specific to riparian management zones.
Thank you. Actually, I'm sorry, I had one last question on the last slide about structures. So when we, or the one before that, I'm sorry, the pretty map. When we say existing structure, I know like when you gave the example of the swing set, it was a swing set or like a playhouse. Are we going to define structure to be like a house or like a structure of a certain size? Because you can imagine, like, especially in a backyard, a lot of like greenhouses and things, or that you don't have to get a permit to build under a certain size anyway. Mm-hmm. And you would want those to be a derived.
Yeah, we got some comments back from our consultant about that, of like they've seen, you know, other jurisdictions really struggle with this. So I'm going to take a look at their language and recommendations there about, yeah, what is sort of a qualifying structure, but ultimately it does need to tie into thoughts about the functions and values of the critical area. So it might be a little bit of know it when you see it, right? Or if there's something that we feel is suspicious, someone saying, yes, this this tough shed that I got from Home Depot clearly severs all riparian management zone ecosystem functions. We have the ability to say, will a qualified professional attest to that? Because that's what we're going to need. So if it's, if we feel it's suspicious, we do still have that option.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's great. So this visual is fantastic. I do want to echo Chris, like, this is really helpful. And also, I just want to compliment the sort of response to the to what we were talking about when we brought this up the first time, that we were concerned about going too far and about adding a bunch of parcels with, you know, homeowners being impacted. I feel like this strikes a really nice balance between exactly doing what DFW extra letters wants us to do, to be a sort of pristine old growth forest, and the reality of where we're at. So I'm really appreciating that there are exceptions and that they seem really clear and well thought out. So thank you for that. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Do you have more for us?
Yes.
Okay.
It's about critical areas report requirements. just in summary, there are a lot of changes here, but they are really focused on deleting repetitive language. The code asks for stormwater pollution prevention plans at least 7 times. We can just ask for it once, and it's a requirement, and don't need to keep repeating ourselves. We are proposing to reduce the requirement for third-party review. So this is when you have a report prepared by a qualified professional that you submit to the city and says, hey, this impact could occur if they do this appropriate mitigation. Currently, our code says, all right, we're going to send that to our third party to review that, and the applicant will be paying for that review. So they've paid for a report to be generated and paid for a report to be reviewed by another qualified professional, sort of, you know, peer checking their work, because on staff, we're planners and not necessarily geotechnical or biologists or wetland specialists, right? We're planners. What we've seen is that that creates a lot of additional time, creates a lot of additional cost, and if we have really specific report requirements that we can clearly understand that they've met the criteria, necessarily sending it out for third-party review, is that getting us a better outcome? So our proposal is to just require it when the director determines that it's necessary. So if someone's doing something that we've just never seen before, if it's a really out there proposal, or if we've been repeatedly asking for items in the critical areas report that we're not getting from their qualified professional, we can say, okay, we're at an impasse. We're going to send it to on call, and if they say that this is okay, we can proceed. So that's the proposal there, because presently our code mandates many times that it goes to third party review. We're also proposing to consolidate standards so they're easier to find. This is more of a user experience. There's a lot of scrolling around and bopping back and forth trying to understand all of the criteria, trying to get them tightened up in one spot. And we are trying to pull out some specific standards out of the code and put them into a submittal checklist instead, because when it's in the code, that really limits our ability to have much discretion about what is required. This can create a lot of back and forth with applicants. And if it's in a submittal checklist, that gives us an opportunity to have more discretion, because sometimes if it really depends on the scope of the proposal. If you really need all of the code stated requirements for a site plan, for example, versus if it's something small like a deck addition, maybe we can back off some of those and really calibrate so that we're understanding the impact. And so that's just more of a for your information. A lot of changes did happen But they're about becoming more concise, eliminating repetition, and getting more discretion for staff, especially to sort of calibrate what is required on a site plan, things like that. So the next steps for this one is that in 2 weeks, we'll come back to see a fully reorganized code. That's what we have sort of uncovered through this process of trying to just sort of make these small edits to the code. It's still creating a lot of issues with navigability. So the plan is to essentially repeal the code and replace it with new language. A lot of the language is, again, just consolidating, eliminating repetition, and trying to be really clear about what it is that we actually want to see from these reports to reduce the back and forth during permit review. So October 2nd, that's the target date to get this back to you, and then to have a hearing in November and then go to council later this year.
Awesome. I have one clarifying question that just popped in my head from something that Chris said earlier. If there are overlaying codes within the critical areas code, overlaying types, I'm assuming the most restrictive is the one that sort of wins, sort of to that point of you're on a slope and you're in a riparian management zone, there's an exception, but the other one, the one that's more restrictive. And is that clear for users?
Yeah,
that's all
I'm trying. There's a little bit of nuance there. Essentially, often critical areas, they'll, it's often not just one, right?
Right.
Someone can very frequently have steep slopes as well as streams, for example. That's a pretty common one that we see. And essentially, we require critical areas reports prepared by qualified professionals for all associated disciplines. So if a geotechnical professional needs to be engaged because you're building a house in a steep slope that also has a stream at the bottom, we would say, okay, from a geotechnical perspective, which is really focused on hazards, what is allowed, what's the appropriate mitigation? And then from a stream perspective, which is more about functions and values of the ecosystem, what can we do for the impacts there and the appropriate mitigation? They'll often end up being related, but slightly different.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. That was purely curiosity. Anything else on critical areas, y'all? Oh, Brad.
Yeah, can we go back to the 500-foot expansion slide? Mm-hmm. I've got... I'm kind of struggling with this one a little bit, partially because we're not 100% clear on what necessarily the on-site mitigation might be, but also, like, from this graph, first of all, thanks for adding all these graphics. That has helped a lot going through this for me. But I think, is there, like, so we've got the 500-foot kind of going, I guess, up on this, on these figures, but... is there like a limit for kind of how far out away from the stream they go? Because it seems like it could be like a huge, potentially huge chunk of area within the RMZ that would potentially be reduced in quality. And how does the mitigation kind of interact with that? Would it be like a area equivalent or something else?
Yeah, so the requirement is that the impact not be any closer than 100 feet from the stream. So there is you can't get closer than that. If you are closer than that, you're probably looking at a reasonable use permit. You're just too close. There's a requirement that it not be closer than the existing development. And the proposal is that the on-site mitigation plan be consistent with our current mitigation requirements, which require a no net loss of ecological function. And presently there's a requirement that it be equal in size to the area of impact. Based on the comments I received from our consultant, they said there's a little nuance there. Like, yes, the area that can be helpful, but it's really more about the ecological functions than about the area of impact. So it's going to be important for a biologist to take a look at the existing ecological functions, determine that baseline, And then, okay, if we're doing this addition, how has that brought down any ecological functions and values, and how does mitigation bring that back up to baseline or exceed baseline? So right now, as it's written, it's about sort of a square foot per square foot. And I got some feedback that you might consider it being a little bit more about ecological functions and about square feet of impact.
And are there any like maintenance requirements for the mitigation areas? Like, do they need to like go back 5 years, make sure they're still healthy? And,
okay, yes, cool. So that it all points back to our mitigation standards, which say that in a stream area, you're looking at a 5-year mitigation plan with annual monitoring that can drop to every other year. It depends on basically what the qualified professional says, how it's doing in that first year. And if it's going great, they're like, we can probably skip next year and we'll do every other.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else? Thank you, Ben. I see nothing else on critical area code. So we will come back for a reorganized code on October 2nd, which doesn't seem very far away.
No, it doesn't.
All right. So moving on, unfinished business. Anyone? New business. See, I just need to do all these together. Reports and announcements. Still nothing. Okay, agenda for our next meeting?
I think you just said it. Critical areas code. Yeah, so that'll be I think as of now, the one and only topic for October 2nd. So thanks, Carlos. The public hearing for the docket as well. Okay. So the 2025 comprehensive plan docket. So that's the level of traffic stress, countywide centers. I think those are the two items. So we'll be having public hearing that night and or the critical areas code.
Perfect. Excellent. And if there is nothing else, no good of the order, I declare us adjourned. Thanks, y'all.